Action of the Senate Committee on Rep. Two bills under consideration, House Bill 2157 and House Bill 2612. I will ask the staff to give us a overview of House Bill 2157. That is the bill that we will work first. And so, that's what we should do, is just orient the committee to the workings and purposes of House Bill 2157. Mr. Gates will give us the presentation. Morning, sir.
Morning. House Bill 2157, Dick Gates, for the record, Legislative Revenue Office. Passed the House already, a vote of 57 yea and 3 excused. We're dealing with short-term or short-rotation hardwood stands. And what the bill does is for Western Oregon in Section 1, 321-267, increases the maximum rotation age from 10 to 12 years. And then for Eastern Oregon in Section 2, 321-415, it does the same thing. And that's the only change in the bill. Now, I did put together a little sheet here for you, which sort of lays out where the various pieces are of the law that relate to short rotation hardwood. What you've got, first of all, is an election for this type of property, for land that's put into the growth of short rotation hardwood. If the owner claims a reforestation tax credit, then they are treated like regular forest land. But otherwise, they can elect to be treated as farmland, essentially. And what the effect of that is in 321.05 is to exempt the harvest from that land from the forest products harvest tax. And then it requires that the land be assessed as farmland for property tax purposes. And it exempts them from both Eastern and Western Oregon privilege taxes. And so that's basically what you're dealing with.
Mr. Chair.
Questions, Vice Chair?
There isn't a policy question here, it's just a number of years. We've already made the policy to exempt the hardwoods from that. It's just a rotation time.
Yes, and actually the change to 12 years has already been made as far as the Forest Practices Act is concerned. This would make the two consistent.
Okay. So what we're doing here, Mr. Yates, is coinciding our tax policy with the stated objectives. In management policy that's come from the Department of Justice.
I think that's fair, yes.
One more time, Mr. Chair.
I'm surprised, sir.
This is, we're essentially talking about the cottonwood plantations?
Yes.
Actually, I think there's another, there's really an unspoken policy here. Those folks that are going to extend their rotation and harvest cycle beyond 12 years would come under a different section of the Act. What we're finding is that hardwoods now are being used for dimensional lumber in addition to chips.
Is that hardwoods, huh?
Yes. Yeah, really? Incredibly, there's like a growing market for dimensional hardwood lumber. So we'll be interested to see that.
I'm going to use that in any project I've done.
Well, you've got applications. So, just, I think it shows you that if there's anything we can grow in the way of forest products, we can utilize them. Questions on the purpose of the bill? Hearing and seeing none, we have three folks that have signed up to speak to this bill. Let's open the public hearing. We'll start with Mr. Craig from the Oregon Department of Agriculture. Good morning, sir.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Chuck Craig. I'm the Deputy Director of the State Department of Agriculture. House Bill 2157 is what we believe is strictly a housekeeping bill brought forward by the department at the request of industry. The 95 session of the legislature and subsequently the 96 special session extended the period of time hybrid poplars could be grown to harvest from 10 years to 12 years without being subject to the Oregon Forest Practices Act, in effect continuing the status of these trees as an agricultural crop for an additional 2 years. At the time, as staff has described, the harvest rotation period in the corresponding tax statutes was not changed. It's our belief, again, that this is a housekeeping measure, and we brought it forward after being contacted by industry who noticed that there was a discrepancy between the tax laws and what had happened in the Forest Practices Act.
Questions from Mr. Craig, Mr. Vice Chairman?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a curiosity question, Chuck. How much acreage do we have in this now?
Mr. Chair, Senator Beyer, I don't have a total. It is certainly in the tens of thousands of acres, maybe approaching 100,000. What's a little hard, we have some large contiguous stands that were started, some by James River on the west side, some by Potlatch on the east side, and perhaps some of the representatives of those interests are here and they could speak to that. But we have poplars being grown as, in effect, as a nursery crop for propagation as well. So, and I don't honestly know what the total acreage is.
Who has oversight of the industry? Is it the Forestry Department?
Until they're 12 years old, the Department of Agriculture would. And then, if they go beyond that, they become subject to the Forest Practices Act under existing law.
Has there been any studies on, I know a lot of it was started experimental, that it would work? Have we developed any knowledge beyond that? Is it a crop that we should be promoting in Oregon?
Mr. Chair, Senator Beyer, I believe certainly it is. The original impetus for it was as a furnish to supply what was believed was going to be a shortage of pulp, short fiber, hardwood fiber for pulp. That market's still pretty soft. The markets that seem to be, I think, developing now is one for trees for the treatment of wastewater from municipal and industrial processes is a big demand for nursery stock, in effect. But also there's, I think, very significant growing interest in other uses besides as a furnish for pulp, dimensioned lumber, possibly energy in the form of pellets or chips or some type of configuration of the wood that could be used in combustion.
Mr. Vice Chair, there's a breakthrough body of evidence that shows that poplars also are very valuable to remediate heavy metal pollution in ground, not just groundwater, but in ground stuff.
Right.
So these trees are being now utilized not just for the wood fiber, but also just as a planting.
Right.
Because they draw tremendous amounts of groundwater and they have the unique ability to fix heavy metal in their fiber.
And
what we do with them after they fix the heavy metal is a curiosity.
But
they are good for remediating fiber.
Right.
But at least it's fixed. Mr. Chair, Senator Byram, one thing I might add is the grass seed industry, who I know Dave Nelson is out of town today and couldn't be here, sponsored a considerable amount of research in the growing of poplars or the potential to grow poplars on some of the heavier Willamette Valley clay-like soils that previously had been thought not to be very suitable for poplar production. And the results of that work was very surprising in that a lot of those soils that at one time we thought weren't good candidates looked like they had potential. So the area in western Oregon that that you may be able to grow them is much better, and that's also, I think, a very positive indication for the use of poplars in the sort of remediation work that Senator Farioli alluded to.
Just a curiosity question, you sort of sparked an interest. Has there been any discussion or research into potentially using poplars as along streams? I mean, planning like that, I think of shelter belts in the Midwest as a remediation for some of the non-source point pollution.
Yes, Mr. Chair, Senator Beyer, very definitely. Poplars are one of the cottonwoods are one of the things that are looked to first as a stream bank stabilization sort of.
I was thinking a little further than that. I mean, one of the issues that I'm figuring out how to deal with is the runoff of fertilizers. I know most of the farmers would like to keep it in the ground rather than that, but it's a sort of a barrier between with their ability to soak up a lot of that.
That is being researched. I'm not aware of any of that as a widespread practice in Oregon yet, but it certainly holds the potential.
Are they profitable enough that if you were planning as an alternative to grass seed or something along Willamette, that would be an alternative crop that would yield an equal value?
We thought when we started sponsoring the research as an alternate crop to grass seed that it would be as a furnish in the pulp market.
Mm-hmm.
That market's very soft right now. I think it's questionable whether it will be at the moment. I don't really know beyond that what to say. I think we have some folks from industry here that I would much rather have them relate their knowledge of the subject than me.
My turn is chomping. It looks like he keeps wanting to head out the door.
The bill should pass.
The bill should pass. Thank you, Senator Minnis. Further questions for Mr. Craig? Hearing seeing none, we'll ask for Mr. Eaton from the Potlatch Corporation. And Mr. Miller, would you like to come forward also? And Jefferson Farms. Good morning.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. First of all, thank you for allowing me to speak with you today. For the record, my name is Jake Eaton, and I work for Potlatch Corporation. Potlatch farms over 17,000 acres of hybrid poplar near Boardman, Oregon. Initially, we started the farm about 7 years ago to grow fiber for pulp. Due to market conditions and other opportunities that we have observed in the roundwood market, the more solid wood market, we've shifted our management focus to now manage for solid wood products, veneer, lumber for plywood, molding, and these types of applications. I'm here in support of House Bill 2157 and to say that without the 12-year rotation, our new management focus would likely not be possible. And I know there's quite a bit of interest amongst the committee, so I'll just stop and answer any questions that you might have.
Questions, Mr. Vice Chair?
So what size of the tree do you get in 12 years?
We hope to get about 11 to 12 inch diameter at breast height tree, which would be roughly 14 to 16 inches at the base of the tree.
Pretty fast. Does it take a lot of irrigation?
They are intensively managed with weed control for several years, controlling pests, fertilization, and irrigation. Irrigation, of course, depends on the age of the tree. I think if you look at our growing cycle and you look at a normal crop rotation within that 10 or 12-year period, we're very close to the same amount of water used by traditional agriculture or slightly less.
Is any of your production going into strand or away from bowl?
There is in other parts of the country. And
I'm interested in the Northwest.
Yes. Not that I know of. We have done trials looking at the material in oriented strand board and other types of fiber board, and it does work very well. It's another potential opportunity.
Question, Senator Castillo?
Thanks. I saw, I think it was on Oregon Field Guide, they profiled, was that your operation that they profiled?
Yes, it was.
Oh, okay. That's what I thought. Couldn't remember it. That was really interesting to see what you're doing with poplars and all the different applications that people are discovering. It's very helpful, too. So.
Yeah, it's for an old dirt forester, it's a really interesting project to me. I can see a full rotation in one lifetime, or if not more than one rotation. So it's very exciting.
And I'd like to say, for the record, there are no growth poplars.
In the desert.
There are no growth poplars. Spotted owls don't live in it.
Otherwise, you'd have to put them in a lockbox.
No, we've got all different types of wildlife that are attracted to these plantations. We've got a sizable herd of elk in our plantation.
And that would be where?
Talk to me after the hearing.
Specifically.
And what time of day?
Hi.
Just at the GIS coordinate. Other questions? It's turned out to be an incredibly versatile and emerging science and in possibly emerging markets for Oregonians. We hear a lot about the rhetoric is that, well, no one's ever proved you can do more than three rotations on this side. And we're now into the third rotation on some sites, are we not?
I know that we're at least into the second rotation, and I know from work that Fort James did that there was no soil degradation after the first rotation. In fact, the nutrition on the site was actually enhanced by growing trees.
Do these trees also fix nitrogen?
No, they don't.
Question?
Forgive my curiosity, Mr. Chairman. Who's buying dimension lumber? What are they using for, pellets? Or?
The pellet would be a low-value application. We are just in the process of trying to form markets for this material. We think it's got an application in the marketplace of its own and won't necessarily be a replacement for alder and other types of hardwoods.
Even furniture frames?
Some furniture framing. One application for black cottonwood currently is intercore for plywood, and this the lower grade material would certainly have an application for intercore for plywood.
Wood to work with.
Yeah, we like to think that at least the hybrids through our breeding program and selection of different types of varieties, that we can minimize some of the adverse types of wood quality issues with poplar.
You're not going to get the fuzziness of the wood when you try.
No.
You can guarantee that.
Okay.
Well, they also want me to grow square trees, too.
Square trees.
You can peel it, you can fletch it, meaning slice it, you can chip it and reform it. It makes good moldings, it's light and strong, doesn't have the tensile strength or the crush strength that some other woods do, but for a lot of applications, those are not necessary.
So. Our interest is probably way beyond most of the committee.
Any other questions? Mr. Miller?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. I will maybe just skip through some things that would be repetitive to what Jake said and talk maybe about some of the other uses of poplar. Senator Beyer, you asked about restoration work as kind of our specialty. But I will kind of run down a list of things that is meant to us as a Willamette Valley farming operation, and we are selling the product into eastern Oregon, so it has both an east and a west application along the same lines that I'm reading. But what it has meant to us is we've sold about $100,000 in logs for veneer production between 1990 and the year 2000, so we're evidence that you can sell the material. We are in our second harvest, and so in my lifetime I will see three harvests off of these, and this is for veneer logs, not for pulp. We have currently that amount again in production, and as we speak at this moment, we are planning in two counties with a crew of 10 people. We've sold easily in excess of 10 million poplar starts in our nursery. That goes to Eastern Oregon, Western Oregon, probably five states, two countries. We have easily planted in excess of 400,000 poplars on our own farm for stream bank restoration projects alone, and we've developed an industry that is using this product for bioengineering. These are wattles and fascines and dormant stakes and dormant sticks, very highly engineered products for stream bank restoration. The beauty of using poplar for those is it's fast rooting and it replaces rock. It has a soft, hard characteristic that's a little bit, you don't want me to go into it, but it has a very high bioengineering and engineering application for stream bank restoration. My father bought...
Senator Minnis has a question.
Where can we get like a brief synopsis of all of this research and all these wonderful things poplar does? I'm thinking of my daughter's environmental sciences class. It might be nice.
Well, we're involved over at Oregon State on Wednesday teaching part of a class, so I guess she could go to that.
Again, I'm busy.
Now that answers the question about who does Senator Minnis' daughter's homework.
He's on to me.
What I think we're asking is if there's a if the Department of Forestry has the latest research extracts so that the public can get this. Is it posted on a website?
Probably not the Department of Forestry. I think it's been individuals such as myself and Mr. Eaton and others that have developed this over the last few years. And, for example, the Oregon Field Guide was a perfect example of that. And we were the second part of that segment, which was the stream bank restoration stuff.
Mr. Eaton, is there a...
It appears important.
We've put out some general brochure-type things with general information about our project. A lot of the really detailed research is proprietary.
So you personally would be available for Senator Minnis' daughter's open paper.
I'll just kind of give you an example of what I'm talking about. My daughter's involved in an environmental sciences class at Reynolds High School. Now, they spend a lot of time talking about environmental issues and stream bed restoration, so on and so forth. But if this use of poplar is such a wonderful idea, and I believe that it is, because actually Tony Van Vliet's former daughter's husband, son-in-law, was also related to me, wrote his doctoral thesis, I think.
Dr. Howe.
Right, Dr. Howe, on the same subject, and it's been around for quite a while, I think. So, but having this available knowledge for students who are taking environmental science classes is important to get kind of an industry-based solution in the hands of some of the young minds. And being a conservative Republican, I like the idea of having industry-based solutions as opposed to some of the lunatic ideas that I hear from some of those that I would consider on the very, very, very far left, excluding my friend Mr. Corfin here. But in any event, it's just nice
so
to have those ideas available for students who are taking these classes, because environmental science classes are becoming ever so popular anymore. But I think a lot of the teachers who are teaching the classes, I don't think they have this information or much of it.
I think it's really ironic that you point out that there's an industry-based solution. We're just beginning to understand the values and the abilities of these trees as an organism. And then there's the value that's created in society from the production of these things. Yet the environmental community has spent a lot of energy and time condemning the production of plantation farming of heartwoods.
Really?
Absolutely. It's just one of those things that,
Why?
The first announcements were that there were some tremendous potentials for these trees, and the very next thing we heard is that they were a terrible blight on the landscape and possibly horribly damaging to the environment. It's propaganda, and it's very irritating. And it, Senator Minnis, I think the point you make is very well taken. We should not allow our society not to be aware, cognizant, and very interested in biological controls for pollution and other things. That's a perfect example. We really ought to get behind this sort of thing.
If I could make one comment, my daughter won a statewide award with the study of the hybrid poplars.
Can we get a copy of that?
Is that on the web?
Is it published or is it proprietary? Oh, no. But it related to phytoremediation and science, looking at the roots and nitrogen uptake, and it was a combination of the Oregon Episcopal School and the Oregon Graduate Institute, and she won a statewide award for phytoremediation in science. We also have a video that shows the application of these things into stream bank restoration and bioengineering, so you're welcome to both of those if there are any.
I'd love to see that. Colleagues, am I preventing the committee from moving this bill
forward?
By educating the
more we talk, the more they're going
to it's fascinating.
Just one last, well, maybe it won't be a last one, but I assume, it seems like last time I was over at the Force Labs at OSU that they were doing some research in this area.
There is an industry sponsored cooperative at Oregon State that has to do with genetic engineering of poplar and other tree species. Completely a research co-op at this point. They don't really do a lot of work on research on the physiology and actual cultural applications of trying to grow the tree. It's more of a research molecular biology.
This is at the Forest Products Lab?
It's run through Oregon State University.
I'm thinking of the lab itself that's there, the fort that you pay. Well, I don't know whether the Softwoods pay taxes for that or.
They do, yeah.
Shaking in the back of the room. But last time I was over there, they had some exhibits along the walls dealing with some of that.
Okay.
Now, how much? I don't know.
We've done work with the Forest Products Lab in the past on doing strength and fiber analysis of different varieties of wood.
Now, this is essentially, this is the same, roughly the same hybrid species that they're using in the Midwest and the North Midwest to grow the trees for the plantain, for the strand board, isn't it?
It is, yeah. It's the same species, different varieties. Of course, those varieties are more appropriate for the upper lake states, or more cold tolerant and things like that.
I assume the reason we don't have a lot of it into strand board is that they don't have any strand mills out there.
Right. That's true.
And they don't use the whole logs that far.
Yeah. There's a couple in Canada that use native aspen, and even now we're starting to grow hybrid poplar for strand board.
Colleagues, shall we close the public hearing and work session on the bill? We'll open our session on House Bill 2157.
Mr. Chair.
Vice Chair.
Move House Bill 2157 to the floor with a due pass.
The Vice Chair moves House Bill 2157 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Are there any questions on the motion?
Are there any objections to the motion?
Hearing and seeing none, so ordered. We need a carrier for this bill.
Anybody still want to?
Senator, it'll be an honor to have you carry the bill. So the Vice Chair will carry.
Just a comment. This is one that is, we were coming out of the last recession in the early 90s when I was fresh into the legislature. Mr. Henneman and was so kind to introduce me to the then chairman of the board, who's working for a different company now. We had a discussion. In fact, I had a discussion with the largest companies. Is there anything that we could do to encourage the production of board, strand board, and others in this area, and was treated very politely, but reminded that these companies also own plants in the Midwest. But still would like to see that happen in the Northwest. Would love to see this industry grow. Great industry.
It's got great advantages for the West Coast.
Senator, I think the cost of capitalization would be willingly borne by the private sector, if we can show the private sector certainty of supply, especially from the public land managers who've been so recalcitrant and derelict in their obligations to protect the land and serve the people through active management.
Mr. Chair, I would suggest that if we were getting into this business, it would be a private, because the lands we're going to grow are lowlands, which are primarily private ownership.
Well, it's been my experience that certainty of supply in private lands has also been affected by the prosecutions of the Endangered Species Act, which have been difficult. Perhaps this administration will have a better approach than the previous administration. Thank you, Mr. Fire.
Mm-hmm.
Let's move on to the next bill before us, and that would be House Bill 2612. And we'll have Ms. Martin Mahar will make a presentation and orientation to the committee on the purposes and workings of House Bill 2612.
Mr. Chairman and committee members, with House Bill 2612, A, engross, it passed the House Revenue Committee unanimously, and what it is doing is allowing the Board of Property Tax Appeals to hear reductions in the real market value and assessed value when the property has been damaged or destroyed and reassessed as of July 1. So it also allows an appeal of the maximum assessed value if the property has been damaged or destroyed due to fire or act of God, and the assessment date is July 1st. It is conforming two statutes in Law 308-428 and 308-146-6 by deleting the property, by deleting the requirement the property must be damaged or destroyed by fire or act of God. And so what you see is Section 3 of the bill, subsection 6, is deleting language, but it is conforming that deleted language to 308-146, which is in the Section 4. So basically we're moving that information from Section 3, subsection 6 is deleted, and then we're it is conforming 308-428, the Section 4, to that deleted language. So basically what it's doing, in 1999 legislature, we had House Bill 2044, and this created a new section in the law, 308-428. And under that new section, then, an owner of property that had been damaged or destroyed property by fire or an act of God between January 1st and July 1st, so there's just, these are the conditions that have to hold as a property owner, had their property destroyed or damaged by fire or act of God between that six-month period, between January and July, then they could apply to the county assessor to have their real market value and assessed values determined as of July 1st of the current year. So this new section, 308-428 and House Bill 2044, was actually very similar to some existing language that already was in place in 308-146. The main difference between those two statutes that was established in 99 was that the damaged or destroyed property does not have to be due to fire or act of God in the 308-146. So basically under current law, what we have now is that only property values assessed as of January 1st can be appealed to the Board of Property Tax Appeals. So this is what we're dealing with in this bill, are the appeal values. So if you're a property owner who had your property damaged between January 1st and July 1st, but you wanted it appealed then, you could not have it appealed under current law. So property values which have been reassessed then on July 1st due to damage or destroyed property cannot be appealed.
Question?
So, Elizabeth, in short, then, all we're doing is taking the timelines off and saying if your property is destroyed, you can appeal it.
Senator Byer, that's correct. We're allowing now any property, no matter when it was assessed, to have that property value appealed. But we're also now allowing beforehand in the statutes, you could only have maximum assessed value appealed if your property was damaged or destroyed due to fire or act of God. Now we're allowing maximum assessed value to be appealed no matter how your property is damaged or destroyed.
And that's the result of House Bill
20, that last session.
Right.
Yeah.
44. That would
be included
by acts of arson.
Okay. that would, in House Bill 2044, converted to Oregon Revised Statute 308.146.
That created that new statute. Okay. But it was real similar to existing language, so that was kind of the confusing part.
Senator Menes is recognized.
Well, I've got kind of this off-the-wall question, but what if you damaged your property with a meth lab and blew the thing up? Do you now qualify for an opportunity to appeal the value of the property?
Senator Menes, I think that, in fact, environmental damage is the basis for requesting reassessment.
So you blow your own nose up, make with your own meth lab, and you can get it reassessed.
Well, Senator Minister, I think the assumption would be if a landowner were cooking meth and that in a RICO statute prosecution, they'd be in fact converting that land to public ownership anyway.
Now, not necessarily with Measure 3. You have to have a criminal conviction. Seems to me, Mr. Chairman, we shouldn't allow this kind of an adjustment where the destruction or damage occurs out of criminal conduct, criminal activity.
Is there an exception in the bill that exempts criminal conduct?
Mr. Chairman, no, there is not.
Meth labs are a bit of a problem in the Portland metro area.
They are, Senator Minister. The concern I would have by doing that is that you beg the question about all criminal actions. And for instance, an accidental release of diesel fuel from a storage tank.
That accidental wouldn't be criminal.
Well, it could be. It could be under certain circumstances prosecuted under criminal statutes.
Yeah. Accidental.
Even if it were an accident.
Accidental.
It would be. It could be classed as an environmental crime.
Accidental release.
Yes, sir. I'm trying to get it across here.
Well,
you can have an unintentional release of a fuel or a caustic substance in a manufacturing process, and actually have that prosecuted as an environmental.
Well, Mr. Not to argue with you, but generally crimes require some kind of mental intent or some significant recklessness. Something where you would have or should have known that the conduct you're engaged in would result in the damage or injury. And an accidental release, I don't think, would qualify.
Okay.
I'd love to see the statute. We can fix that.
We probably ought to look at that. I think it'd be under the Endangered Species Act, the Clean Water Act.
Well, so you're saying it could be prosecuted as a federal crime?
Yes, and a state crime.
Well, then we don't have no control over that.
There are instances where, for instance, people have exceeded the permitted effluents for air and water, and
accidentally, without knowledge.
I'm almost certain that they get special treatment. It is a civil issue. I understand what you're saying. You're talking about intent being the determinant on whether or not it's criminal.
Mr. Chairman, I can understand there may be fines by the EPA in the in a civil process, but a criminal indictment generally requires some form of mental intent
mm-hmm.
or recklessness that rises, again, to the level that they would have known or should have known, i.e. they were warned that your conduct could result in the damage.
Do we have anyone here present that can speak to Senator Minnis's question? About whether or not.
That was a pretty quick set back
about,
down.
About whether or not the intentional misuse or criminal use of a private property could in fact result in a tax appeal being granted to a perpetrator who had not been criminally indicted. Is that your question?
Well, I'm just saying that again, where people are engaged in criminal conduct and they damage their own property, we shouldn't allow them to claim some potential reduction in its assessed value.
Very reluctant witness coming forward.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is John Phillips. I'm with the Department of Revenue Property Tax Division. Just say a couple statements ahead of addressing Senator Minnis's question. The bill was this is not the Department of Revenue's bill. This is a bill brought by the Clerks Association. And the original intent, as I understood it, was in Section 1 to add an appeal period or appeal venue to the Board of Property Tax Appeals, which is a local board, for certain situations that weren't currently allowed. Then the bill expanded to sort of clean up and combine some other statutes that Elizabeth referred to from last session. So. There has been a little bit of history, and I'll make it as short as I can. There was an issue in Measure 50 when the assessment date was moved to January 1. Property is valued as of January 1, and then the taxes are then billed in November. Things happen to property between January 1 and November. And one thing that was recognized and acknowledged was that property can be damaged or destroyed. But under only limited conditions was an adjustment to the tax allowed for the following year, and that was damage or destruction by act of God, or by fire. And so it did limit it to those kinds of things like earthquakes, tornadoes, lightning strikes, those kinds of things, or fire caused by any means. Then, last session, that section that was referred to earlier, I think it's...
308.146.
That was added, yes, but also 308.428, which in Section 4 was added. And what basically the concept there was to say that if property is damaged or destroyed, we're going to move... It's like moving the assessment date to July 1. That way it gives the property tax owner a more accurate look at their property as of July 1 if it was significantly changed. But still, the principle of Measure 50 is that maximum assessed value that was set, that rollback number, was not reducible. It always advances or it stays level, but it never reduces. The exception last session that was allowed was is that maximum assessed value could be reduced, but only in 308.146 for a fire or act of God, and only in those circumstances. So both fire and act of God, damage and destruction, or just regular damage and destruction, can have a new assessment date, if you will, of July 1. But only damage and destruction due to act of God or fire could have their maximum assessed value reduced.
Question, Mr. Vice Chair?
So this really changes some, if, or whatever, I don't know why someone would do this, but if an owner of, let's say, an old mill decided it wasn't profitable anymore, they could go in and knock the structures down, scrape it off, and under the old law, would they be, under the existing law, would they be able to reduce their property assessment?
Chair Ferrioli, Senator Beyer, yes, they would. And this statute has historically and currently provides a trigger for accelerating the acknowledgement of that damage and destruction. So under current law or previous law, if you destroyed your property through a bulldozer, tore it down, the following year it would be, your value would be reduced, your real market value. Okay. But if it occurs between January and July, you could accelerate that 1 year by getting it acknowledged 1 year earlier.
So is that the effect of this one that just gets it quicker?
The original intent of this bill is to bring the appeal to the Board of Property Tax Appeals, which only hears current year appeals. And this makes that July 1st date rather than the January 1 date considered a current year appeal. Yeah. So
it accelerates it and keeps the issue local.
That's correct. Mr. Chair and Senator Minnis, now to your question. What this bill would do would if your property was destroyed through a criminal act, and you decided to ask for a property tax reduction, you could ask the assessor for a redetermination as of July 1. That's what this bill would allow. And then it would allow an appeal on that decision. The assessor would look at the property as of July 1 instead of January 1 and would look at the condition and say, has it been deteriorated? Has the value been reduced? And if it has been reduced, the assessor would make that determination and in the following November would bill you for the lesser amount. The one issue the committee might want to consider relative to that is that in any case, the following year, the property value will be reduced. So it's what you would be making a distinction between is all this bill does is accelerate the acknowledgement of that reduction in value by 1 year, the year that it actually occurs, because in the subsequent year, it would be acknowledged anyway. That.
I'm not satisfied. I honestly think there needs to be some. I don't care. You're still going to provide some kind of benefit to some moron that blows his house up, maybe one or two, but I'd like to see some provision that at least acknowledges that this board may deny a reduction in the value if their wrong damage behavior occurs because of criminal conduct on behalf of the owner.
Senator Minnis, I can see all kinds of good reasons to have that in statute. The question I've got is, are we asking the tax assessor to determine whether there was criminal intent?
Pretty easy when the guy tells you I blew it up with a meth lab. You have a keen sense for the obvious.
Chair Farrelly, Senator Minnis, there was a provision in the law prior to last session that only allowed a reduction in maximum assessed value for acts of God or fire. And so acts of God would be obviously beyond the control of any human interference. The fire was only allowed if the fire was not caused by arson. So it did in that instance say that if you were responsible for burning down your own house, that's a criminal act and you should not have your value reduced. And what they meant by that was you shouldn't have your taxable value reduced. So there was an acknowledgement, and there has been an acknowledgement of that in the statute, but
through deleting it by,
well, actually,
act of God or fire.
Senator, did I understand correctly that was deleted by the last change? Does this bill do that deletion, or is it already deleted in statute?
Chair Farrelly, I think this bill actually expands the conditions under which your property's maximum assessed value can be reduced to any damage or destruction.
Okay. Senator Minnis, did you want to bring amendments relative to arson and criminal action?
Yes, sir. I would be glad to have them drafted.
Yes, Ms. Martin-Lavar.
Senator Minnis, you might want to deal with the issue of, do you want all the values to not be reduced or just maximum assessed value? Because that's all this bill was doing as far as changing is the maximum assessed value.
I don't want to change the direction of the bill. I just assume it's maximum assessed value.
But Senator Minnis, they still could have a reduction in their real market value. That's still allowed under current law. So if you want to change that, then just make sure council knows that, or, you know.
Sure.
I think staff will help me with this. She's certified smart in this area.
So I think the senator refers to you, Ms.
Yes.
Okay. Certainly not referring to me.
So Senator Menendez.
So they'll know it when they see it.
Right.
Senator Menendez, do you want all three values, real market value, assessed value, and maximum assessed value, to not be reduced due to arson?
Yes.
Is that correct?
Arson? Necessarily.
Criminal act.
Criminal act.
And I guess the other issue is, while you're in the neighborhood, would you try to answer the chair's muddled question about when issues under the Endangered Species Act or Clean Water Act, which would appear to be civil issues, might become criminal issues?
Just as you form it, and I'm supportive of the idea, you just need to make sure that you do it in a way so that, remember, these are citizen bodies that are lay bodies that are given, that they have sort of a bright line that they can use to hang their hat on.
And
there's been a lot of work on that with the forfeiture cases and that, so I think Senator Menendez understands that issue very well.
Actually, I think I'd like to talk to the city of Portland and just see what they do.
Well, that kills me first.
I didn't say Portland School District.
They do red tag some properties, you know, after an explosion, meth lab, something like that.
Can I also ask our committee staff to consult with the Judiciary Committee, who refers this bill? This came from the House Judiciary.
Okay.
And if we're going to add to that, then we'll ultimately have to have a concurrence. So just to make sure that they understand that it was Senator Minnis who brought this issue.
Yeah, I'll ask them why they didn't raise the issue of their own.
Mm-hmm. This didn't come out of revenue?
Yes, it did come out of revenue.
Yes, it did, but by way of judiciary. Yeah. So it would be a good thing to talk to the folks in judiciary. We'll add this to our issues of topics of
that's the problem.
Those judiciary committees.
There you go. But we'll also talk to our revenue House Revenue Chair Shetterly about the implications and the fact that you may be adding another course correction to which I think is an excellent concept.
Less attorneys on the Judiciary Committee, I think, is good.
So, colleagues, I'm going to assume that we are not going to move into work session on this bill this morning. We'll expect our good Senator Minnis to bring one or more amendments to the bill, and we will reschedule it for continued public hearing and then work session at a later day. Closed the public hearing on the House bill 2612, and colleagues, I believe tomorrow is scheduled tomorrow is scheduled for sure, but on tomorrow's schedule is Senate Bill 260.
So we will, I believe, have the report from the group that met on February 28th, and they'll be bringing their recommendations to the committee for what to do with Senate Bill 260.
Gives me reason to live. Thank you so much, Mr. Chair.
Yes, Senator Corcoran, it's my job to keep you focused. I believe we're out of session until tomorrow morning at 8:30.